Okay, let's begin. Today's shiur has two themes, two parts. The first part of today's shiur will be discussing the basic hashgafic messages of Tu B'Shvat. What is Tu B'Shvat all about? What are the basic approaches of Tu B'Shvat mentioned by the Mefarshim? In the second part of the shiur, we will be discussing the Torah's approach to wealth, based on the Darash Moshe, or Moshe Feinstein, and we will discuss the Torah's approach to wealth, and as a backdrop for Rav Moshe's approach to Tu B'Shvat. Rav Moshe has a very unique, very deep approach to Tu B'Shvat, and his approach to Tu B'Shvat is based on and expresses an approach to the Torah's approach to wealth. So that'll be the second part of this year. Okay, now, Tu B'Shvat is a Yom Simcha. It's not a major day of Simcha, but it's a Yom Simcha, you know, to a certain degree. We don't say Takanon on Tu B'Shvat. If a person gets married on Tu B'Shvat, the minig is not to fast. Most people have minig to fast on the day when they get married, but not on Tu B'Shvat, we don't. So it's a Ksas Yom Simcha. It's Yom Simcha Ksas. So the question is, what exactly is the Simcha of Tu B'Shvat all about? The Gemara says that Tu B'Shvat is Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos. It's in the Mishnah. So what exactly is the Simcha about the fact that the Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos? I mean, it's a very nice thing. It's the birthday of the trees. But what's the hashgafic message of Tu B'Shvat? You know, what are we celebrating? What is the Simcha about? Okay. So I want to present the basic approaches. I'll be quoting mostly from a sefer by Rav Yoel Schwartz Shlita. Rav Yoel Schwartz has written a whole series of svarim. They're very small svarim. He takes a topic and he presents the basic ideas in Chazal and the Rishonim on that topic. I lost count how many he has. Maybe 30 or 40. He has one on Hanukkah. He has one on Purim. He has one on the Kedusha of Am Yisrael. He has one on Zionism. He has one on the Shoah. He has one on marriage. He has one on the importance of learning Torah. He has a whole list. He goes on and on. These very short, brief svarim. Mostly it's gathering Makoros from the Chumash, the Midrashim, Chazal. He quotes the famous Achronim. He quotes a lot from Rav Hirsch. Okay. So in his Sefer on Chanukah, it's called Yemei Chanukah, at the end of that Sefer, he has a brief discussion of Tu B'Shvat, around 15-20 pages about Tu B'Shvat. So most of the Makoros that I'll be quoting, I found there in his Sefer on Tu B'Shvat. Yeah, the Sefer is called Yemei Chanukah, and it says, V'nosaf ro, and in addition, Kuntras Inyanei Tu B'Shvat. There's a Kuntras, that's what that means, like a pamphlet on the topic of Tu B'Shvat. Okay, so first he quotes Rav Hirsch, who says as follows: the simplest approach to Tu B'Shvat is, Tu B'Shvat is a time that we celebrate nature, we celebrate Teva, we celebrate the greatness of Hashem that's reflected in the natural world. When a Jew celebrates the beauty of nature, he's really praising Hashem for creating the beautiful world that we live in. Here's what he says: it's a time l'histaklut b'nifla'ot habore b'teva. It's a time to look at the wonders of Hashem in the Teva. Malabu Masecha Hashem. Now, why do we daftly use Tu B'Shvat? Because Tu B'Shvat is the beginning of the cycle. That's the whole point. As the cycle begins anew, since it's the beginning of the new year for the trees, the cycle begins anew. So at the beginning of the new year, sort of the winter is basically finished. We'll get back to that later. The winter is basically finished. We see the natural Teva cycle starting again, and we appreciate the wonderful world of Teva, the natural order that Hashem gave us. And we are Sameach in the greatness of Hashem. And we are Sameach. And we appreciate the greatness of Hashem that we perceive in the natural world. That's one standard approach to Tu B'Shvat, that we celebrate Teva, i.e., Marabu Masecha Hashem. Now, just to be clear, I just want to make this clear. This idea that Tu B'Shvat is Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos, the idea is as follows. The Gemara says that by as follows. It says Tu B'Shvat is Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos, And the Gemara says, why? And this is Gemara Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Aleph. Nishum sheyatsu rov gishmei shana. Because by then most of the rains have fallen. What does that mean? So Rashi explains that the rain, when it falls and enters the ground, it provides nutrients for the trees. And Rashi says that by the time Tu Bishvat has come, there's enough rain in the ground. The ora hasraf beilanos, the nimsa haperos chontin meyatsa. The sap has gone up the trees. In other words, the Tu Bishvat is the very beginning of the cycle. The sap is in the trees. The trees now have their potential for producing fruit again, and therefore we celebrate. And therefore, that's how Tu Bishvat is considered the beginning of the natural order. The trees might not. The trees are not going to blossom for a little while. They might not blossom till the spring, but the potential to start blossoming again is already there. The sap is in the trees, and so therefore that's the beginning of the natural cycle. So we celebrate the wonders of Hashem reflected in the natural order on Tu Bishvat. Okay.
But that's point number one. But number two, Rav Schwartz quotes from Rav Hirsch, who goes even further, that Tu Bishvat is not just a celebration of the natural order and Marabu Masech Hashem, but rather, Rav Hirsch explains that Tu Bishvat is a symbol of the fact that the Teva is able to renew itself. The idea of renewal. The cycle is beginning again now. The trees are ready to blossom, but then we've had a long winter. During the winter, everything falls off the trees. The trees, in a sense, die. I mean, the fruits die, the leaves die, and they're gone. Now that the winter is ending, we see the potential of the fruits for the next year. So it's the idea of renewal, that nature can renew itself. This idea of renewal carries a lot of symbolism for Bnei Israel, because, as our first explains in a few places, the idea of renewal, that even after a long galus, the winter is always a symbol of galus. In winter, it's dark, and it's a more difficult life. That's like galus time. They always go together. So Jews have always had the ability to renew themselves and to keep going with Naam Hashem, even during the long galus. So this is the idea, that the idea of renewal is a major aspect. It's a major theme of Bnei Israel. And we have to renew ourselves and keep on serving Hashem the way we served Hashem even before we were in Galus. So the message of Tu Bishvat is the idea of the renewal of the world, not just that nature is great. The first point is that nature is amazing, is great, and Marav Masech Hashem. The second shot is more specific, that within the world of Teva, the idea that Teva can renew itself again every spring, that is a theme of Tu Bishvat, which reflects an important yesod for Bnei Israel in general. Rav Hirsch. Oh, by the way, Rav Schwartz is quoting mostly from the collected writings of Rav Hirsch in the Breuer's community in Washington Heights. Over the last 15 years, has published the collected writings of Rav Hirsch in 8 volumes. So, in the first 2 volumes, Rav Hirsch has essays on the various months of the year. So, Rav Schwartz is quoting from there at the end of volume 2. Rav Hirsch has several essays on Tu Bishvat. Okay, so they're very important svarim. They're very good to have. Rav Hirsch, aside from writing his parash on the Chumash, and aside from writing Chorev, and aside from writing the 19 letters, and a parash on Tehillim, among other things, Rav Hirsch also wrote many, many, many articles in German in his Torah magazine called Yeshurun. And those German articles were later gathered and published in German, in the collected writings of Rav Hirsch in German, and again more recently they've been translated into English by the Breuer's community, the 8 volumes of the collected writings of Rav Hirsch. Okay, so Rav Hirsch goes on to explain that this idea of renewal is also the basic message of Kiddush HaChodesh. The mitzvah is that Eidim see the new moon, they go to Beis Din, and Beis Din is Mekadesh HaChodesh. So Rav Hirsch explained that Kiddush HaChodesh symbolizes this idea of renewal. The moon at the end of the month gets smaller and smaller until it disappears, and then it comes back little by little. It meets the sun again and comes back, and the light of the moon shines forth again. So too with people. Sometimes we have sorrows. People appear to be weakened. They have difficulties. And it looks like they're almost gone. And then we always come back. Bnei Israel always has this sense of renewal, that we never fully are destroyed. Even when it looks like we have difficulties, eventually we come back. Our first writes, but each time the moon finds the sun again, each time it receives its rays of light afresh, Hashem wants his people to find him again and to be illuminated with fresh rays of his light. Wherever and however, in running their course, they have had to pass through periods of darkness and obscurity, the moon, finding itself again in conjunction with the sun, is only to be a model for our finding ourselves with Hashem. The rejuvenation of the moon is a picture of, and an incentive to, our own rejuvenation. So this is the symbolism of Kiddush HaChodesh. Our first year is really mentioning two different points. One on an individual level, and one on a national level. On an individual level, a person might find himself far from Hashem, if he has chataim or difficulties, and then the moon should be aside so we can recover and get close to Hashem again. We discussed this idea at great length in our shiur on the Kiddush HaChodesh, which I quoted extensively from our first year and developed this theme at great length. And two, on a national level, that Am Yisrael as a nation will always survive and always be able to renew itself, that's also symbolized in the idea of Kiddush HaChodesh. You know, it's interesting, the mitzvah of Kiddush HaKodesh is the first mitzvah given to Klal Yisrael as a nation. In Shmos Perek Yud Beis, it's the first mitzvah we have received as a nation. Why? What's so special about Kiddush HaKodesh? So according to our first, we have a beautiful explanation. Since Kiddush HaKodesh symbolizes the idea of renewal, and you're always able to come back and serve Hashem better, it's a fitting beginning to the mitzvos. It carries a very, very important message. The idea that your job is to serve Hashem, and no matter how difficult things get, and even if you have tzaras, even if you're in a rut, you catch yourself and you come back and you recharge your batteries, you rejuvenate yourself to continue serving Hashem. Okay. Anyway, so our first points out that this sense of renewal is exactly one of the messages of Tu Bishvat, that the nature has renewed itself and it's starting over again, a new cycle. So that's another message. That's an important idea of the Simcha, that it's a positive message for us, that B'nai Yisrael should recognize that they're always able to renew themselves and start again. So these are the first two basic simple pshatim of the Ashkafic message of Tu Bishvat, the idea of Marav Masech Hashem and the idea of renewal. Now Rav Schwartz adds a third point that flows out of the first two, which is as follows. When we say Tu Bishvat is a symbol of nature beginning again and the natural order and renewal, of course we're referring to the natural order in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, this idea that the robe of the rains have fallen already and the sap has come up in the tree really only applies in Eretz Yisrael. In many other countries, it rains all the time. So we see here that the idea of establishing Rosh Hashanah Ilanos was established after the natural cycle in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, Tu Bishvat becomes a day where we focus on the uniqueness and the specialness, the singularity of Eretz Yisrael, the milos of Eretz Yisrael, because the whole focus of the day is based on the natural order in Eretz Yisrael. And that's why Rav Schwartz explains the idea of eating the fruits of Eretz Yisrael obviously fits very well on Tu Bishvat, because on Tu Bishvat we're celebrating the cycle of renewal, which is renewal of the natural order in Eretz Yisrael. So it makes sense that we focus on Eretz Yisrael and we eat the fruits of Eretz Yisrael. Many Chassidish Rabbanim, many people, they have like a Tu Bishvat Seder. They'll eat the various fruits of Eretz Yisrael, and that's one of the ideas of Tu Bishvat. Rav Schwartz points out in a footnote as follows. There's a custom that developed that people plant trees in Eretz Yisrael on Tu Bishvat. Rav Schwartz claims that there's no specific makor for that idea, to daskas are planting trees on Tu Bishvat. However, he thinks that as a remez, one could say this is the idea. Since Tu Bishvat is a time of focusing on Eretz Yisrael and the uniqueness of the natural world in Eretz Yisrael, so we plant trees. And on Tu Bishvat, that's what Rav Schwartz writes, maybe as part of that, as an expression of that idea, emphasizing, stressing the natural order in Eretz Yisrael. He says it might be based on a pasuk. The pasuk says, you come to Eretz Yisrael, when the tatem kolets maichel, and you're going to plant fruit trees. And he quotes Chazal. Chazal say, "Kishatan nechasim eretz Yisrael, lo tisasku ella b'mata tchila." You should plant. So since Tu Bishvat at the time we focus on eretz Yisrael, so one of the ways a Jew focuses on eretz Yisrael is by planting trees. That's what comes out from Chazal, and that might be the mukkah for the minhag of planting trees on eretz in eretz Yisrael on Tu Bishvat. Now, our first actually goes further and gives a third shot about the nature of Tu Bishvat, the nature of the Simcha on Tu Bishvat. It's a very deep idea, and I wanted to share it with you. It goes as follows. See, it's interesting. On Tu Bishvat is not the time when the trees start blossoming yet. Tu Bishvat is officially the middle of the winter. It's the middle of the winter. Teves Shvat Adar, it's the middle of the winter. The spring starts in Nisan. So Tu Bishvat is a time where, although it's the middle of the winter, the sap has gone up the trees and the potential for the blossoming is there. The blossoming is not going to happen for a while. The potential for the blossoming is there. So our first says as follows. The 15th of Shvat is the new year of the trees, the birthday of blossoms even in the middle of winter. Think of him and experience the joy and exaltation with your Hashem. When the season changes and thousands of buds and blossoms herald the arrival of spring, we celebrate with jubilation not only Hashem's festival of nature's reawakening, but also the divine festival of our own spring. But in the midst of winter, the Jew points silently to the defoliated trees. Behold, today they are celebrating the birthday of the coming spring. Under this torn, dark, cold bark, new fresh life pulsates. A powerful lesson emerges from this truth, our verse continues. Men are bent by sorrow, bent by grief, pain and grief. They had harbored beautiful dreams of their future, proudly wearing the crown of their efforts, intoxicated with the unlimited power of their might and deeds. A violent force robbed them of their fruits, and the storms of life smashed their flourishing hope and joy, destroyed the glitter of society, and broke the halo of their power and might, and left them poor and defenseless. In other words, we're in the middle of Golus, and we have Tsaros as a nation. We're in the middle of Golus, the winter, the dead of winter is a symbol of the Golus, and yet, in the middle of the winter, a Jew celebrates the coming spring. It's a very exciting idea. In the middle of the winter, a Jew celebrates the sense of renewal in the dead of winter. Our verse continues. He says, on the 15th, on the birthday of the spring, in the midst of the winter, leave your homes. Behold the trees on the day of their birthday and recall the beauty and harmony of their appearance, decorated with fruits and crowns of leaves, branches and twigs. Winter robbed them of their fruit and colorful leaves. The storms and cold broke branch after branch, twig after twig. The twigs and branches broken by the storms were dry, brittle, and lifeless, but their inner core remains alive and fresh. They will always weather the storm. That's Rav Hirsch. What Tu Bishvat symbolizes is that the Jewish people, even in the middle of Golus, we have trouble physically. We're being oppressed. We have the emunah to realize, listen, you may be hurting us physically now. We might be down right now. But our inner core, the fact that we're the Am Hashem, Hashem's on our side, gives us the confidence, the knowledge, we're going to survive this. That's the emunah bitachon, that we celebrate this even in the middle of winter. This is a very deep symbolism. We are celebrating the coming of spring now in the middle of the winter. The sap is in the tree. Right now, the tree shows no outward signs of life, but the inner core is still alive. That's exactly the message of Klai Yisrael. Klai Yisrael, no matter how downtrodden it is, how physically oppressed it is, our inner core will survive. We are the Am Hashem. So the very deep symbolism of Tu Bishvat adds another layer of simcha to the day. The simcha being that Judaism, we're optimistic. We have emunah and bitachon that Hashem is going to help us ultimately, and that emunah and bitachon will help us continue and make it through the long golus until the Mashiach comes. But the goyim can't destroy our inner core. We always are going to survive, as a nation. That's a third symbolism of Tu B'Shvat. It's a beautiful pshat that Rav Hirsch gives. That idea is in volume 2 of the collected writings, page 330 to page 333.
Okay. So these are, I would call, maybe three of the standard approaches to Tu B'Shvat, all based on Rav Hirsch. But aside from those pshatim, I also want to talk about Rav Moshe's pshat. Rav Moshe's pshat on Tu B'Shvat is based on Rav Moshe's general approach to wealth. And Rav Moshe's approach to wealth, I think, really reflects a basic yisod in Torah Hashkafa. Rav Moshe has a sefer called the Darash Moshe. It's Rav Moshe's sefer on the Chumash. It's a beautiful sefer with the Yivrei Torah on the Parshios and in Yonim in Hashkafa. Rav Moshe is known as being a great posek, one of the gadol Adoram Tzak. He was also a tremendous gadol in Agadata and Jewish as well. It's mamash a wonderful sefer. So Moshe has a theme in the Darash Moshe that he mentions in several places. One is in at the end of the sefer, Jewish Tes Zion, starting from page Shin Ches, and that's one place where he mentions this topic. But also by his board on Tu B'Shvat on page Nun Beis, he has a similar idea. He has a similar idea on page Ayin Tes, if you're interested. And the truth is elsewhere, as other places as well. Now, the idea starts as follows. Rav Moshe on page Shin Tes talks about Orla. Orla is a very strange mitzvah, as Rav Moshe points out. Orla means that the halachas of Orla is that for the first 3 years you can't eat the fruits and you can't get hanah from them at all. That's incredible. You can't get hanah at all. That means you can't even give them to an ani. There's a poor person down the block. He needs food. I have Orla. I can't give it to him. I can't sell the Orla and buy him a sandwich with the money. It's very strange. Why would Hashem give me a mitzvah which for 3 years I can't even use the food for a mitzvah? I can't give it to money. What's the pshat? What's the hashkafa behind the mitzvah of Orla? So Moshe explains as follows. He says as follows. Jews have to realize that any wealth which they have is not really their own. Any wealth a Jew has really is owned by Hashem. Hashem allows us to use His wealth under certain circumstances. If you have $1 million, it's not your $1 million. It's Hashem's $1 million, and Hashem has given you distribution rights. You are like the legal guardian over the wealth. Hashem has made you like a shomer on that money. It's not your money, it's Hashem's money, which you're allowed to use under certain conditions, like giving tzedakah, etc. This is the Yesod of the Darash Moshe, which he applies and uses in several places. Now, this is a big Yesod. Now, how is Hashem going to teach us this Yesod? How is Hashem going to teach us the Yesod that money in the bank, the food that you have in the money in the bank, the food in your wallet, it's Hashem's money, which you're allowed to use? That's a hard feeling to get across. A person works hard, makes money, puts it in the bank. He feels, that's my money. I worked hard for it. It's mine. A farmer plants and grows food. That's my food. How is Hashem going to teach us this lesson? That really it's Hashem's food, just we have distribution rights. The answer is, that Moshe says, that's Orla. Orla is a three-year training process, a three-year training period, to teach us we don't own our own food. For the first 3 years, you're allowed to touch it. You can't touch it. You can't use it at all. Hashem wants you to treat your fruits as if they were burned up and destroyed. They're yours. They're on your trees. They're right outside. But you can't use them. You can't even give them to an ani. What does that teach you? It teaches you that the fruits are not really yours. Hashem wants to teach us this lesson. That your food and money is not your own. It's Hashem's, which you have distribution rights over. So Hashem goes to the extreme. He teaches us that lesson by saying the first 3 years of the fruits from your hard labors, you can't use them at all. He says, Lufi Zer, Rav Moshe says, Hu Toeles Gadol, it's a big benefit. She Yitzragel Ha'adam Bazer Lehachshiv Af Ma Shemunach B'yado V'otzro Kisaruf V'omed, as if it's burnt up, meaning, if Hashem doesn't allow you to use it, it's as if it's burnt up. You can't use it at all. This is the idea of Orla.
it's as if it's muta lefanav kupa malea afar. It's like it's a big pile of dirt. If Hashem says no, the answer is no. But this is the pshat of Orla. Orla is the training period to recognize the proper Jewish approach to the Torah approach to wealth. The money is not yours, it's Hashem's, and you have distribution rights over it. And we are supposed to take this lesson and apply it to wealth in general. Rav Moshe says, this is the pshat in a famous pasuk. It says, you know, Ayis hal chacham chachmaso, Ayis halel ashir b'ashro, Ayis halel b'ibor b'kvuraso, etc. Now, these are good things. Wealth, power, and wisdom are good things. One of the good Rav Moshe writes on page Shin Nun Aleph, B'hukah sheyodea she'enam shelo, Hashem is giving them to you to watch over for him, to use for him. He's testing you with them. That's pshat in the pasuk. If you think it's yours, if you think it's chachma, so it's your chachma. If it's your gvura, hashir ba'ashro, then you have a problem. Then that's the problem. That's pshat in the pasuk. When you think it's yours, if you realize that these are things that Hashem, presents that Hashem has given you, which you're supposed to watch over for Hashem and use for the right reasons, then they're not bad. Then they're good things, Taka. But the pshat in the pasuk is, don't take pride when you think it's yours. That creates the problems. That's Rav Moshe's yisod. That's the yisod of Orla. Rav Moshe continues and says, that's the pshat why in the fourth year, you go to Netzer Ravah, you have to bring to Yerushalayim. The message being, it's the fourth year, you're going to start eating your fruits, but eat them under my conditions. You have to eat them in Yerushalayim. That fourth year is also part of the training period. The first 3 years, you're being trained to recognize that your wealth is, in a sense, not your own, unless you do what Hashem says. In the fourth year, you're being trained, oh, now that you are using it, you have to use it under my conditions. And that's why Netzer Ravah, you take an Eitan Yerushalayim. Okay. So Rav Moshe's vort about is an application of his basic yisod of the Torah approach to wealth. Rav Moshe has another application of this principle on page Shin Ayin Vav. He quotes there the idea of Yerushalayim Ronis Chalko L'Shvatim. Yerushalayim wasn't divided up amongst the Shvatim. That means Yerushalayim was not officially owned by any Shevet. There were some Jews who lived there, but it wasn't owned by any Shevet. Like, for example, you weren't allowed to charge rent if people came to the old city of Yerushalayim, because it wasn't officially split up the Dinei Mamonos amongst the Shvatim. What is the Hashkafic message of this idea? Rav Moshe says as follows, that the Jewish people came to Yerushalayim 3 times a year on the Shalosh Begalim. But Moshe says that's why the Beis Hamikdash is in Yerushalayim. Hashem put the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim so that we would come to Yerushalayim, to the Beis Hamikdash 3 times a year, and we'd see, oh, no one here owns any land. That would remind us that regarding our own land, back where we live, that we should recognize, oh, just like Hashem, the Beis Hamikdash is in a place that technically no one owns the land, we should learn this lesson and recognize that all the land that we have home, that we basically own, quote-unquote, is really Hashem's as well. In other words, the lesson of being exposed to Yerushalayim 3 times a year was to teach us this yisod, that you should view your own house, your own land, as Hashem's land, which He's allowing you to use under certain conditions. So that's another application of this yisod of the Torah's approach to wealth. Okay, based on this yisod, one can have a good explanation for a difficult parsha in the Chumash. In Parshas Vayishlach, you know, Yaakov was coming to meet, was bringing stuff over the Nahar, over the river. He was going to meet Esav, and he was by himself, and he fought with the Malach, etc. Okay, so Rashi quotes from the Gemara that Yaakov went back over the river. Why? To get pachim ketanim, small pots and pans. This is very strange. Yaakov was, relatively speaking, a multimillionaire.
And it's very strange that he would go back for a few dollars worth of pots and pans. What, was Yaakov a miser? Was he a penny pincher? That, you know, that he couldn't handle losing $5? We know it's not true. Yaakov wasn't a miser. We see other places where Yaakov gave up all his money if he had a good reason to. One time was when Esav sent Eliphaz to after Yaakov to kill him. And Eliphaz caught up to Yaakov, and Yaakov convinced Eliphaz not to kill him. But Eliphaz wanted to fulfill Kibud Avein. So Yaakov said, okay, you know, there's a din that if you have no money, it's like you're dead. So I'll give you all my money, and then it's like you killed me. So Yaakov gave up all of his money, mamash, all of his money to Eliphaz. I mean, Yaakov was not a miser. He just wasn't. Later on in the Chumash, there's a medrash that says that Yaakov didn't want Esav to own anything of the Maris HaMachpelah. So Yaakov gave all of his money to buy Esav's portion of the Maris HaMachpelah. Yaakov wasn't stingy. He wasn't a miser. If he had a good reason, he spent all of his money. So why was Yaakov going back for pots and pans? Now, it's interesting that, you know, Chazal praised Yaakov for doing this. Chazal praised Yaakov for going back for the pots and pans. It's the Gemara in Chulin, Daf Tzadi Aleph. The Gemara in Chulin quotes, by Yivasa Yaakov Levado, Yaakov was by himself. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Shenishtayer Al Pachim Katanim, Mikan with Tzadikim, Shechaviv Alehem Amonam Yoser Migufam, Bekokach Rama, Lefishem Postim Yidein Begezel. This shows Tzadikim are very careful with their money. Why? Because they want to avoid, they want to avoid Gezel. It's clear from the Gemara that Yaakov was praised for this. The basic fact that Yaakov went back for the $5 was for the few pachim kanim was correct. And the question is, why? How does it fit with Yaakov's personality to go back for a few dollars? Now, I just want to clarify this point as follows. The Gemara goes on to say that there was a mistake in what Yaakov did. The Gemara goes on to say, by Yovik ish imo aragos hashachar, Yaakov fought with the Malach. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, mikama tamar chacham, shelo yetze yichidi balayla. Yaakov made a mistake by going back by himself. That was a mistake that he made, that he shouldn't have gone out by himself, it was dangerous. But the basic yisod of going back for the pachim tanim, it's clear from the Gemara that that was a positive thing. I looked around a little bit, I'm not aware of any makoros that say, the first thing that say, that based on this Gemara, it was a mistake to go back at all. So Yaakov is praised for going back, but the Gemara says it was a mistake that he went back by himself. Okay. Now, why did Yaakov go back? Why did he go back for the pots and pans? So this is a famous question which the Mefarshim discuss. In general, when you're learning Agadatas, in the Gemara, the first place to look is the Marsha. The Marsha explains every Agadata in the back of the Gemara. Then you have the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov is a separate sefer which quotes several different perushim on all the Agadatas and Shas. Another place to look is the Maharal. The Maharal explained every Agadata. The Maharal explained many of the Agadatas and Shas. And then there's a sefer called the Ben Yehoyada. The Ben Yehoyada also gives explanations for the various Agadatas and Shas. So here, the Ben Yehoyada and others give pshatim as to what exactly Yaakov was doing. Also, but I once heard a pshat about why Yaakov went back for the pots and pans from Rabbi Rav Lichtenstein Shlita, and the pshat that he gave was basically along the same lines as the Yisod which Rav Moshe developed. He didn't quote Rav Moshe, but it's along the lines of the Yisod which Rav Moshe Zatzal developed. He said as follows: if a person feels that his money is Hashem's money, and he's just a shomer over the money, then of course you go back. Because it's not his decision to be mochel on the money. Let's say I gave you 5 pence to watch for me, and you drop 2 of them as you're walking along. And you say, you know what? He probably doesn't care. The pens aren't worth that much. You can't do that. You can't be mochel on my money. It's my money. If it's your money, you're mochel on it. And a person's mochel on his possessions. But you can't be mochel on somebody else's money. So what if you think it's not worth much? But it's not yours. You have no bias. You have no say to be mochel on somebody else's money. Yaakov felt the money was Hashem's, and he was just the shomer on the money. Therefore, of course, he had to go back. The more a person feels that anything that he owns is really Hashem's, and Hashem is giving him distribution rights, Hashem makes him the shomer, then of course you have to go back. It's not yours. You're a shomer on Hashem's money. I think it's a very, very deep shot. It's exactly this. Of course you have to go back. It wasn't his. He was Hashem's shomer. Meaning, Yaakov felt as follows. If Hashem, for some reason, has given him pots and pans, then he has to watch over them for Hashem and use them for the proper purposes, not throwing them away and just losing them is not their proper function of why Hashem gave it to him. That's why Yaakov was supposed to go back. Yaakov shouldn't have gone back, he shouldn't have gone back by himself. But going back was the correct thing to do. You can't mochel on somebody else's money. I think it's a very deep shot. And this shot is mamish along the lines of what Rav Moshe writes in other places about the basic yesod in his basic yesod to the Torah's approach to wealth. Okay, I mean, you know, there are other pratim as well to what why Yaakov went back. But this is, I think, a very beautiful shot, which fits well with the theme that we've been developing in this year. Now, if one has this approach to wealth, that Hashem puts money in my control and allows me to use His money under certain conditions, then how a person views tzedakah will be different. How one's approach to giving a tzedakah will be affected by having this basic approach to wealth. Let me explain. A person works hard for a living, and he feels that by giving tzedakah, he's saying, I am giving to the ani my hard-earned money as tzedakah. That's how people usually approach tzedakah. That's what people usually think. But according to Rav Moshe's approach, the truth is, one should view tzedakah slightly differently. The money which you're giving to tzedakah wasn't really yours in the first place. Hashem put money under your control under the condition that you give some of that money to the anim, to tzedakah. It's not my money and I'm doing, it's not that it's my money and I'm doing you a big, big favor by giving it away. It's not my money in the first place. The money is flowing through my account on the way to the anim. A Jew, when he gives tzedakah, is fulfilling the basic condition of what it means to have money in this world. You don't have full distribution rights and usage rights over the rest of your money until you give tzedakah. For example, let me give you a mashal. Let's say you work for a law firm and you work in the accounting department of the law firm. So all the money comes through you. You sign all the checks. When you write the checks to give out to the lawyers in the law firm every month, are you being exotic? No, you're doing your job. Your job is to distribute the money the way that the heads of the company decide. If you say, you know what, this money, I'm not going to send the check out to the lawyer. You can't do that. That's stealing. You'll go to jail. If a Jew doesn't give tzedakah, they're holding back the ani's money that Hashem put in his account for him to give to the ani. In a sense, it wasn't yours in the first place. But this is an approach to tzedakah which flows out of this approach to wealth. And it's exactly based on this yesod that Rav Hirsch and Rav Soloveitchik both say a very, very similar vort. They point out as follows. The word tzedakah comes from the root tzedek. Tzedek means justice. You know, living a correct life. Chesed means doing somebody a favor. The word tzedek means justice. So Rav Hirsch and the Rav both say that that's why tzedakah comes from the word tzedek. Because the giving of tzedakah is the appropriate thing to do. It's the just thing to do. Because Hashem only gave you the money in the first place to distribute it to the anim. Rav Hirsch writes, almsgiving, giving tzedakah, is called tzedakah, a word that connotes justice rather than love. Rav Soloveitchik says a similar idea. He says we normally view tzedakah, b'muvan asiyat tova l'zulat, doing a favor to someone. He said, tfisa zu himut'eit, this tfisa is mistaken. If the Torah viewed tzedakah like that, it should have called it something like chesed. Im haTorah kareit la tzedakah, bituri hazehe im tzedek, siman muvhaku, ki ein ani osa shum tov alani, v'zu maisha shel tzedek. That's what you have to do. The Rav quotes further that there are some times where based in actually forces people to give tzedakah. You have a shibud to give tzedakah, and based in can collect that shibud and force you to give tzedakah to a certain degree. What's the pshat? The pshat is that this is something that a person has to do. Just like the head of a law firm
can force the accountant to sign the checks. I mean, that's his job. He has to sign the checks.
So too, once with the limitations, there are certain times where Beis Din has the authority to force people to give tzedakah. This is a very deep approach to tzedakah, which both the Rav and Rav Hirsch develop, and it flows very well out of this approach to wealth in general, that it's Hashem's money over which you have distribution rights. Rav Moshe applies this idea to Trumas and Maisros as well. If, you know, the non-Kohanim give Trumas and Maisros in Eretz Yisrael. Now, we own the land. Kohanim and Levim don't. So Hashem says we have to support them by giving them Trumas and Maisros. Now, what's the pshat? So Rav Moshe says the pshat is, that's what we have to do. The Kohanim and the Levim are the teachers of Klal Yisrael. Yo Mishpatechul Yaakov, that's the bracha which the lady received. Yo Mishpatechul Yaakov, they will be the teachers of Klal Yisrael, and they're supported by the rest of us. So by giving Trumas and Maisros, it's not that I'm doing a big favor to the Kohanim and the Levim, giving them my crops. No, that was the deal. We own the land, they don't. We have land, they don't. The deal that Hashem set up is, they don't own land, they're supported by the rest of us, and then so that they can be free to be the teachers of Klal Yisrael. So giving Trumas and Maisros is not a favor to the Kohanim and the Levim. It's a basic requirement of living in Eretz Yisrael that Hashem has given to us. And based on this, Rav Moshe has a chiddush, mamash a chiddush kapshat in a pasuk in the Haftorah of Shabbos Haggadah. This is in the Darash Moshe on page Ayin Tes. There's a discussion there in Malachi, which goes as follows. Bnei Yisrael asks Malachi, hey, why are we getting punished? And Malachi says, because you're not giving Trumas and Maisros. That's the piece. That's one section of the Haftorah of Shabbos Haggadah. So it's a very strange discussion. I mean, if they're not giving Trumas and Maisros, that's obvious. So they should have known. That's why they're getting punished. It's a little strange that they're wondering, hey, Malachi, why are we getting punished? If the answer is they weren't giving Trumas and Maisros, so then it's obvious why they were being punished. So Moshe gives a shot in the Haftorah. Moshe says, no. Moshe says, Nireh shevadai kimu mitzvahs maiser. They were fulfilling the mitzvahs of Trumas and Maisros. And that's why they're confused. Why are we getting punished? But Rav Moshe writes, Hein kimu kemoshe nosni mishalahem. V'zereino keratzen Hashem yizbarach. Elo ritzono sheyedu sheim nosni v'tadabar sheino shalahem. She Hashem yizbarach nosan lahem rach ma sheyishoyer achar afrashish Trumas and Maisros umat nosanim. Vein nosni mishalahem klum. Rav Moshe understands as follows. Bnei Yisrael were giving Trumas and Maisros, but they were giving it with the wrong kavanos. Their kavanos were, this is my money, and I'm giving as a favor part of my money as Trumas and Maisros. And Trumas and Maisros, which says no, that was their mistake. Malchi said you're giving it for the, you're being punished because your hashkafa behind Trumas and Maisros is wrong. It's not your money, it's theirs. Hashem never gave that money in the first place. Hashem gives you money to use and distribute as you like, on the condition that you give Trumas and Maisros the way you have to. It's a very deep shot in the Haftorah. They were giving Trumas and Maisros, and that's why they didn't understand why they're getting punished. But they're giving it for the wrong reason, and with the wrong kavanos. And that's why they're being punished, because they had the wrong approach to tzedakah, as opposed to the fact that they weren't giving the... They had the wrong approach to Trumas and Maisros, as opposed to the fact that they weren't giving the Trumas and Maisros at all. That's a further application of Rav Moshe's basic yisod of how to approach wealth in the Torah. I found a similar idea in the Sefer Rabbi Franden print. Rabbi Fran published some of his tapes in the Torah tapes and put them into writing. It's a Sefer Rabbi Franden print. So on page 186, he has the following board, which I think really fits very well with us, the whole approach that we're developing, the Torah's approach to wealth. When Bnei Yisrael leave Mitzrayim, they took money from the Mitzrayim. The Torah says Vayishalu, that they borrowed the money from the Mitzrayim. So the question is, what's this? And why did the Torah say they borrowed it? First of all, we knew we were keeping it. Number one. Second of all, the Mefarshim point out that we deserved the money. We had been slaves for several hundred years. We deserved payment for all the work that we had given. So why does the Torah say Vayishalu that we borrowed it? So our fan quotes from some of the Mefarshim as follows. There's the Yisod that the first time the Torah exposes us to something,
it is to teach us a certain lesson. For example, Hashem wants us to believe that our food comes from Shemayim. He gives us our food. So, our first exposure to food was the man for 40 years in the Midbar. Hashem was training us that food comes from Hashem. So then we get to Eretz Yisrael, and we plant on our own, we recognize, oh, even though we're planting on our own, it all comes from Hashem. Similarly, Hashem wants us to understand that wars are fought by Hashem. So the first war in Eretz Yisrael is a Neis Nigla. You walk around Yericho seven times, blow the chatzosros, and the walls fall down. That's a training, that's a lesson for us, that Hashem fights our battles for us. Okay. So when the Jews are leaving Mitzrayim, this is their first exposure to owning wealth as a nation. They've been slaves, they had no wealth. It was their money, and they deserved to have the money. But Hashem wanted us to feel that the money is borrowed money. The Jewish people's first exposure to wealth was, it's borrowed. What's the message? You should recognize all your money is really borrowed, in a sense, from Hashem. He's giving you distribution rights if you use it for the right reasons. This is why the Torah says, Vayishalu. Bnei Yisrael had to borrow the money. They deserved, they could have demanded the money. But they borrowed the money in order that they should, that Bnei Yisrael should absorb this lesson, money is not their own, quote unquote. It's Hashem's money, it's somebody else's money. Here it's the Mitzrayim's money, which they're borrowing. But that's a lesson to them. It's not their own money, it's somebody else's money, and which they're just which they're borrowing, they have the right to use. It's a beautiful pshat that Rav Priyan gives about the phrase, the use of the language v'yishalu when the Jews left Mitzrayim, and it fits exactly into Rav Moshe's approach to wealth, as he explained by Orla. Okay, good. So Rav Moshe has his approach to wealth, which is taught to us by Orla, by the halachas of Orla. And Rav Moshe then takes this whole approach to wealth and brings it back to explain, to develop a yesod about Tu Bishvat. And Rav Moshe is trying to explain why we have this simcha on Tu Bishvat. Rav Moshe thinks that the simcha that we experience on Tu Bishvat flows out of this hashkafic yesod that wealth isn't our own. It's all from Hashem, and we have distribution rights to use it as we want once we fulfill Hashem's commands of tzedakah, truma, samaritas, etc. And this is what Rav Moshe says. Now we're going to explain how Rav Moshe takes this yesod of wealth and uses it to explain the yesod of simcha on Tu Bishvat.
Okay, what is the basic halachah l'maaseh of Tu Bishvat? The halachah l'maaseh of Tu Bishvat is that you can't give trumas and maaseros mishana al-chaverta, from 1 year for another. That means as follows. Let's say you grow 100 fruits this year and 100 fruits next year. You have to give a tenth of mice. You have to give a tenth for miser from each year separately. So you might say, listen, you know, I'm a busy man. I can't give miser every year. I'm going to wait until the end of 5 years and give, you know, 10% of 500. Give 50 at the end of 5 years. You can't do that. You have to give 10% of the first year on the first year, 10% of the second year on the second year, etc. That's the pshat. Ein ma'isri nishana al chaverta. Each year is its own like fiscal year for ma'isri. That's the din. Now, what's the hashkafa which flows out of that din? The hashkafa is as follows. If a person's giving tzedakah and he feels, I'm doing a favor, I'm doing something, you know, on my own. So then, if you think you're doing a favor, it's my money, I'm doing a favor. So then you might feel, oh, I'll give tzedakah however I want. I'm not going to give tzedakah the way, in a specific fashion. I'll give tzedakah how I want and when I want. I'll push it off for a year or two. I'll give it in a couple of years. However, you know, for example, you might say, this year I'm a little short. I'll give double tzedakah next year, something like that. Moshe says, no. If you approach giving miser and giving tzedakah with the idea that it's Hashem's money, and you just have distribution rights over it, and Hashem's condition for Hashem's condition for allowing you to use the money at all is if you fulfill the ideas of giving tzedakah, etc., then you can't push it off, because that tzedakah money, in a sense, isn't yours. That tzedakah money is given to you temporarily to be used to distribute as tzedakah, and that's the condition of using the money at all. If you, in other words, if you view tzedakah
the way we've been explaining. It's something you must do because the money isn't yours in the first place. Then you're going to be less likely to push it off till the next year. So the idea of Tu Bishvat is to teach you this lesson. Giving Maisros, giving Trumas and Maisros, giving Staka. It's not your money. You're doing what Hashem tells you must do. The money wasn't yours in the first place. Therefore, you can't delay the Trumas Maisros from year to year. Each year has to get its own Maisros. So Moshe writes, that is the specific Hashkafic lesson of Tu Bishvat, that the money is not your own, and therefore you can't save of Trumas and Maisros from year to year. You have to give Trumas and Maisros of each year of produce that grows independently. And when is the cutoff point of the new year? On Tu Bishvat. Okay. It's a very nice idea. Now here's the punchline. Rav Moshe says that this really is the Simcha of Tu Bishvat, because the idea is as follows. According to this whole approach, when does a Jew feel, you know what, the money I have in the bank, I can really use it now for my own purposes? When do you feel that way? Only after you fulfilled all of the conditions for use. Any money which you have in your possession is Hashem's money. He's giving you distribution rights. You can use it however you want. However, he gives conditions. Meaning you can't use it however you want. You can use it for your own purposes once you have fulfilled Hashem's conditions. The basic conditions are Staka, Trumas, and Maisros. So it's only after giving the Trumas and Maisros and giving the Staka that the remainder of the money is really, in a sense, yours, i.e., that now you have, you know, full authority to use that money, you know, as you wish, you know, use that money freely. So the real simcha of owning money and, like, you know, you make a profit and you can use your profit and spend it on something that you want, the real simcha only kicks in once I've given the tzedakah and the trumas and maisros the way I'm supposed to. So, and that hashkafic message that once you fill your obligations, then the rest of the money you can use, that's the real simcha of Tu Bishvat. Tu Bishvat teaches us the proper approach to wealth, including when you're allowed, in a sense, to really enjoy your money and use it how you want. When you've paid off your obligations of that year's produce, then you can enjoy the rest of your money and use it. It's really yours. That's exactly the luck of Tu Bishvat, that Trumas and Maisros of that year's produce has to be given. And that is the nature of the Simcha of Tu Bishvat. It's the awareness that once I fulfill my obligation of my yearly tzedakah, and that obligation of giving tzedakah yearly is brought home to me and taught to me and emphasized to me by having a Rosh Hashanah Levanos, having a Tu Bishvat. So the awareness is, once I fill those obligations, now I can, in a sense, enjoy the rest of my money freely and use it for whatever constructive purpose that I want. So this is Rav Moshe's angle on the Simcha of Tu Bishvat and how it connects with the Torah's view of wealth. We don't own our money fully. Rather, Hashem has appointed us to be the watchman for Him and has given us distribution rights. You can use the money for constructive purposes. You use the money freely for constructive purposes once you have fulfilled His rules. What are His rules? His rules are giving staka and giving Trumas and Maisros. And where do we see that giving staka is based on His rules and not our own, and not based on our own rules? But where do we see that giving staka is basically an obligation which we must do in order to earn the right to use the rest of our money, as opposed to some very big chesed that we're doing to help out the anim? Where do we know that from? The fact that it has to begin every year, and you can't push it off from year to year. This is Rav Moshe's very deep angle on the Simcha of Tu Bishvat. Rav Moshe writes that once you've paid off your Trumas and Maisros from that year, then you have a Simcha Gedolah. Why? Shebozeh Naaseh, the other Chalakim, the other 90%, Shelo Mamish. It's really yours now to use in a constructive purpose. I'll just read from Rav Moshe's language. He says that if a person realizes that giving tzedakah is a chov, as opposed to some chesed he's doing, so then he asks as follows: you're not going to push it off from one year to the next.
v'hitchil chatzdaka. V'imyase b'chol chodesh or b'chol shavua, yeh yosem eshubach. Giving tzedakah every month or every week is even better. Oh, v'zeh ha'limut. This message, this understanding of the approach to tzedakah, yod'in anu midin tu bishvat. Shebazeh na'asa ha'nishar shalanu. We learn this from tu bishvat. And then once we do this, giving our tzedakah the way we're supposed to, the way we have to, then the rest becomes ours, and then we can enjoy our money and enjoy the rest of our wealth and use it in a constructive purpose and ask Hashem for more, because we're using it the right way.
So the symbol of Tu Bishvat is, it has to do with understanding how and when we are allowed to enjoy, quote-unquote, the money that we've earned, the produce that we've made in a proper way. And it's that awareness of how to use money properly that generates the simcha of Tu Bishvat according to Rav Moshe. Okay, we'll stop here. But after I finished this shiur, I noticed another makor which fits perfectly into this theme, and I wanted to share it with you. It's in the MS Liakov, that is the sefer of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal on the Chumash, in Gracious, Perek Yud Dalad, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. And the same idea is quoted in the article about Rav Yaakov at the bottom of page 210. And Yaakov points out as follows. After Avram won the war in Parshas Lech Lecha, so it says that the Melech of Sdom said, "Teni nefesh v'arachush kachlach, give me the people and you can keep the goods, you can keep the booty from the war." Avram said no. He says, "No, I'm not taking anything. Im yichud v'atzroch now. Yimakach mechor asher lach. V'lo samar ne'asharti es Avram. I'm not taking anything," Avram said. "I don't want any of the goods. I don't want any of the rechush. I don't want any of the booty from the war." Okay, that's Avram. But it's interesting that Avram did give Meiser. In the previous pasuk, it says, "Vayitein lo Meiser mikol," that Avram gave Malki Tzedek a tenth of everything. So it's very striking. The same Avram who doesn't want to take any of the booty, any of the rechush, is giving a tenth to tzedakah. What's the pshat? Shabbat explains the pshat as follows. He says, even though Avram didn't want any of the rechush, he withheld the 10% that constituted the Meiser. Why? That tenth, Avram recognized, was not his to do with as he saw fit. I.e., the Meiser isn't yours. Hashem only gives you the money in general if you fulfill the basic conditions of usage. And the basic condition of usage in general is giving the Meiser. That wasn't his in the first place. It's like passing through your account on the way to the Ani. Rav Yaakov said, "Meiser by its very nature does not belong to the owner, but our charity comes from the start." That's what Rav Yaakov said. Rav Yaakov there was saying that if all people in America viewed stuff the way Avram did and everyone gave Meiser, so then he says Torah institutions would not go begging. There'd be enough money to support the Torah institutions in America. Anyway, that's Rabbi Yaakov's vortz by Avraham Avinu, and it's exactly the same idea. The money is not your own. The tzedakah wasn't yours in a sense. You have to give that. It's a chiv, it's a chov. And then it's a chov. And then only after giving that chov, then is one able to use the rest of his money for himself. Okay, now we'll stop here.